Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 13. A short while later, I clutched the steering wheel tightly as I threaded my way through one axle-breaking cluster of potholes after another on the lake road. When I was still a good distance from the driveway to Newcomb's cottage, a car emerged from it and turned in the same direction I was going. When it did, I recognized Douglas DeWitt as the driver. By the time I reached the driveway itself, his vehicle had disappeared around a bend in the road ahead. "I bet he's taking the dog food to his folks," I announced to my empty car. Normally, such an incidental comment occurs more as a reflex. But when I made this particular remark that particular day, it precipitated a most significant idea. Why not take a quick peek into DeWitt's cottage before going to see Jeff Weintraub, who I really didn't want to see anyway? If I happened to discover something about DeWitt's relationship with McCarthy while looking for the goat, so much the better. This seemed like such a sensible idea, I turned into the narrow driveway without a moment's hesitation. At first I feared that fate would give the finger to my attempts to perpetuate the perfect crime yet again. But then I discovered an open side window with an old collapsible window screen in place. Not surprisingly, though, I couldn't reach it. However, after dragging the garbage can beneath the window and standing on it, I succeeded in raising the sash enough to remove the screen. Once I did that, I hauled myself over the sill and into a small bedroom that revealed nothing more exciting than Douglas DeWitt's clothing and unmade bed. Close examination of the tiny bathroom and kitchenette yielded equally unrewarding results. So now I know he doesn't make his bed, rinse the sink after he shaves, or washes dishes, I told the empty cottage. Considering my son's living quarters displayed similar symptoms of male 20-something existence, I didn't consider that irrefutable evidence of a criminal mind. Then I spotted the sack of dog food by the front door during a visual sweep of the small living room, crowded with typical leftover summer cottage furniture. Either DeWitt hadn't gone to visit his parents, in which case he could return at any minute, or he'd wanted the food for something else. Goat catching, perhaps? Now who do you suppose could have told him about using dog food to catch goats? Rather than speculate on the answers to those questions, as well as any possible implications, I zeroed in on the battered coffee table that appeared to hold the remainder of Douglas DeWitt's personal possessions. Once again, I found nothing to link him directly to McCarthy. Aside from the usual assortment of sports and news magazines, the table held nothing, except several books, including one on dog training. I was about to write off that part of the investigation when I noticed a small slip of paper marking a chapter on aggression in the latter. It bore a single word, Beglethundi. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. However, before I could give that discovery the attention it deserved, the sudden faint but distinct sound of a vehicle on the far side of the lake caused me to hastily abort my search. I quickly replaced the window screen and exited through the front door, which I carefully locked behind me. Feeling somewhat reassured that I could investigate with the best of them, I then raced to the side of the house to return the garbage can to its original position. But before I did, I paused to ascertain the vehicle's exact location. Fate finally gave me a break. I heard nothing except birds chirping. Evidently, the vehicle I'd heard before had stopped at one of the other cottages. Emboldened by that knowledge, I resurrected phase two of my plan, investigate DeWitt's garbage for samples to send to Jim. This took little time for practical as well as aesthetic reasons. First, the receptacle contained only two bags. Second, evidently some scavenger had torn these open, creating a kinetic collage of organic and inorganic matter that formed a wet sludge that pulsated with maggots in the bottom of the container. Fighting my revulsion, I began to examine the contents in more detail, even going so far as to extract a maggot-infested clump and hold it up for further scrutiny. But when a plump maggot slid off it and landed between my toes, I promptly decided that, no matter what Jim's lab could determine from that garbage, I'd find it out some other way. While I leaned against the fender of my car and slipped my now maggot-free foot back into my maggot-free sandal, I grappled with a choice. Should I visit Jeff Weintraub or go home and take a long hot shower to free myself of the stench of gasoline, rotten garbage, and maggot slime? What would a dedicated investigator do under those circumstances? I'll never know. All I know is that, when a light breeze off the lake chose that moment to enhance the fetid odor emanating from me, I knew that not even the chance to prove what happened on that grassy knoll on the day Kennedy was shot would keep me from going home and taking a shower. Besides, I told myself, I'd earned it. I'd just completed my first successful breaking and entering, an accomplishment that didn't even register on my professional radar mere days ago. The glow of achievement that warmed me following that awareness dimmed drastically mere seconds later, when I edged to the side of the narrow road to give wide berth to a troop of swarming Girl Scouts who ignored their leader's shouted orders to watch out for the car. I'd left my fingerprints all over DeWitt's place. I momentarily considered returning to the cottage, but then noticed some of the screaming little nature lovers headed toward the lake via DeWitt's driveway. Instead, I convinced myself that he wouldn't notice any fingerprints unless he looked for them. And I'd given him no reason to do that. However, the thought of his friend Chandler McCarthy's in-depth knowledge of the criminal mind and meticulous attention to detail diminished the appeal of that rationalization somewhat. I could easily imagine McCarthy dusting his place for prints every night, right after he disengaged the infrared camera and the detonator he'd borrowed from his fans in the law enforcement community. Still, whatever DeWitt might be, he sure as hell wasn't McCarthy, and I banished all thoughts of my partner's aberrant behavior from my mind. The next morning dawned crisp and clear, and I fixed some scrambled eggs and toast to boost my spirits. But after all that effort, I couldn't bring myself to eat much. The idea of stealing a used bandage from a lecher while wearing my now even grubbier anti-sex outfit was more than enough to ruin my appetite. However, my mood did brighten considerably when I saw no evidence of man nor beast when I pulled up beside Weintraub's cottage a short time later. Putting my proven plan quickly into effect, I located the garbage can, whipped off the lid, and carefully examined the contents of its sizable, but thankfully intact, collection of plastic bags. Success! I carefully extracted the blood-stained gauze pad I disengaged from a tangle of used dental floss in the third bag. After slipping the possibly incriminating evidence into the sandwich bag I'd brought along expressly for that purpose, I began replacing the garbage bags as I'd found them. But then another idea occurred to me as I studied the neat, maggot-free pile. Might as well check them all as long as I'm here, I explained to the gray squirrel, who chattered at me from atop a stack of wood. I couldn't help feeling a wave of pleasure when I found the shredded remnants of a sheet of transgen stationery scattered throughout the contents of one bag. But that feeling waned considerably when I realized that moisture from a large wad of wet paper towels had smeared the printing on all but two of the tiny fragments. The printed fragments' term and ands that I could barely make out on them did little to cheer me. Still, I told myself, maybe they'd mean something to McCarthy. The image of my reticent partner congratulating me for the discovery of these actually quite meaningful clues instantly evaporated when I noticed a swirling pattern of parallel lines in the sandy soil. Shit. Someone had raked the area. And even an idiot could see that, like the raking of the bedraggled flower bed surrounding Joe's cottage, this raking had nothing to do with gardening, and everything to do with hiding something. I continued studying the swirls as I distractedly replaced the lid on the garbage can, now totally consumed by the idea that Jeff Weintraub was hiding a goat. Feeling more like a Keystone Cop than a skilled detective, I dragged the garbage can around the house, stood on it, and peered in all of the locked windows at the raised back and sides of the cottage, only to discover the front door unlocked. Following a quick but thorough search of the interior, I pronounced it devoid of meaningful evidence, as well as goatless. So what had he done with it? Surely he'd keep an animal that valuable as close as possible. When no answer occurred to me, I returned to the back of the cottage and systematically searched the ground at the periphery of the raked area. Eventually I found some droppings, but only old ones, and not enough to indicate the goat had spent much time there. But while I was scanning the wooded hillside behind the cottage for inspiration, I heard a faint but distinct sound. Goat mumbling. I froze in place, waiting to hear it again. When it didn't recur, I rummaged through the garbage can, this time until I found an empty soup can, into which I tossed an assortment of small pebbles. When I rattled the can, a faint bleat drifted down from somewhere in the woods above me. As fast as my long skirt and flapping sandals permitted, I scrambled up the hillside. When I got about 10 yards from the cottage, I stopped and rattled the can again. "Where the hell are you?" I called, when a slightly louder bleat left no doubt that I was hot on the trail of the missing goat. In my eagerness to find the animal, I stumbled over a crumbling stone wall and inadvertently rattled the can in the process. This time the goat's cry sounded so close, I stopped and observed the lush undergrowth carefully. And then I smiled. Of course, Weintraub was keeping her in a pound. Sure enough, I found the little creature in a small, overgrown, stone-walled pen built long ago when fields rather than woodlands covered the area. Back then, any stray livestock was caught and held in such an enclosure until the owner paid the fine to reclaim it. "You're very cute," I complimented the little goat, a salt and pepper agouti doe with trim black stockings and dainty feet, whose tag identified her as 199. As I slipped my belt around her neck, I grudgingly had to admit that Jeff Weintraub had provided very pleasant accommodations for his hostage. She had a large fiberglass doghouse with a thick layer of bedding, a shiny stainless steel pail filled with fresh water, and top-quality hay. A clean bandage just above one hock covered an area I was willing to bet was missing a chunk of skin and underlying tissue. "Don't know where I'll find you something this good," I cheerfully informed my charge, "but I'll give it a try." You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.